There's a piece which you can write as the gradient of a vector, anti-symmetrized, like this, symmetrized rather, where this vector is also transverse. There's a piece which you can write as a double divergence of a scalar with the trace subtracted off. So like this. So these are the covariant derivatives again with respect to the metric on your manifold. So everything I've written so far here is traceless. This is automatically traceless. This is traceless by virtue of this constraint. And this is traceless. D is the dimension of the manifold. So these two cancel when you take the trace. So the last piece we have to include is a trace piece, which I'll write as another scalar psi proportional to the metric. So the statement is that any smooth tensor field you have can be decomposed in this particular way with unique functions in each slot here. OK, so we want to be doing this for the sphere, which is a two-dimensional manifold. And there's some simplifications which happen in the two-dimensional case. So for d equals 2, it turns out that the transverse traceless part is always absent. There's no way to write a transverse traceless tensor on a sphere. So this part is just gone. The other nice thing about this two-dimensional sphere is that we have a two-dimensional epsilon symbol, anti-symmetric volume form, which we can use to write this transverse vector in terms of the gradient of a scalar. So we can do this. We can write the vector in terms of the gradient of a scalar by using this epsilon symbol. So epsilon is the volume form on the sphere, which I can write as square root of determinant of the metric times times the epsilon symbol. And this thing is just anti-symmetric. So epsilon 1, 2 is equal to 1. And epsilon 2, 1 is equal to minus 1. And the other epsilons vanish. Okay, so when we put these simplifications into our ansatz on top here, we get something that's now in terms of just three scalars, because we have this becomes a scalar, and then we have two scalars here. If we're interested in just the polarization part, we're not actually interested in the trace. If you take the trace of this polarization tensor Fij, that's equivalent to summing over all the polarizations. And that just gives you back the temperature part, which we've already taken into account by doing the temperature. So if we're interested in just the polarization, the new stuff that's in the polarization that's not in the temperature, we don't care about this trace part. So we're interested in only looking at the traceless part of distribution function. So at the end of the day, this all gets written in terms of just two scalars. Where I've plugged in d equals 2 because we're on the sphere. So okay, so we've reduced this. We've reduced expanding a general symmetric tensor that's traceless into just having to expand now two scalars. And we already know how to expand scalars. We just use the ordinary spherical harmonics. So by plugging the ordinary spherical harmonics into here, we define two new tensor spherical harmonics, this part and this part. So I'll write them, I'll write these on the next board. These tensor spherical harmonics are called E and B. Again, written as a function of the position on the sphere. There's a normalization factor out front, which will ensure that it's normalized in a way that I'll write in a second. So this defines the E-mode spherical harmonic in terms of gradients of the ordinary spherical harmonics. Yes?
Could you please repeat why we are throwing away the trace part?
Right. So the trace part, so the original distribution function, Fij, it gave you the probability for observing a certain polarization if I combine it with two polarizations. If you sum over all the polarizations now, so there's two independent polarizations because they have to be, there are three vectors and they have to be transverse to the direction of rotation. So if you sum over all the polarizations, there's a completeness relation, and this becomes just the ordinary metric, delta ij minus a part that's proportional to the direction that it's orthogonal to. So the sum over all the polarizations ends up just taking the trace of F, because the P hitting F is 0. So this, when you sum over all the polarizations, that's like ignoring all the polarization information, which is what you do when you measure just the pure temperature of the CMB. So it's only the traceless part that contains sort of the new information that we haven't taken into account by doing the temperature measurement. Okay, so the E mode was from plugging into the second term up there. From plugging into the first term, we get the B mode. And these factors out front have been chosen so that these are orthogonal in the following sense. Okay, so they're normalized. The E's are normalized. B's are normalized. The E's are orthogonal to the B's in this inner product where you just contract up the tensors and integrate them. Okay, so if you were to plot, you can plot some of these on Mathematica if you're interested. These B modes have a sort of swirling pattern to them, and the E modes have a sort of gradient-like flaring pattern to them. Okay, so we can now take our general tensor. We can take our general polarization thing and we can expand it as a sum over these E and B modes. So we sum over all L and M, A LM times Y of E. Like so. So we have expansion parameters now, A, E, and A, B, which tell you the amount of these E and B modes in your given realization of the sky. So now we can go through and do exactly the same things we did for the temperature. So there's going to be some underlying distribution that tells you about the two-point functions of these E's and these B's with each other. And there's you can talk about the cosmic variance of these E's and B's. It goes through in essentially the same way, just using these. It's essentially the same. And this represents the additional information. These AEs and ABs are the additional information that's in the CMB due to polarization. So these, along with the temperature thing, so there's going to be some C sub L's that correspond to the AE and the ABs. And that, along with the temperature C sub L's, is essentially all the information that's there in the CMB. So these B modes have garnered a lot of interest recently. I'm sure you've been following all the stuff about the BICEP experiment. So that was an experiment to go out and look for this particular B mode pattern. And the reason this B mode pattern is interesting is because, as we'll see when we talk about cosmological perturbation theory during inflation, there are two kinds of fluctuations that emerge. There's the scalar spin zero fluctuations, and there's tensor spin two fluctuations, which are the gravity waves. And if you track through how those fluctuations can influence the polarization pattern, you find that both the scalars and the tensors, can influence these E modes and can imprint on these E modes. But only the tensors can influence the B modes. So by looking for the presence of these B modes, you can see whether the tensors are there, because they're not contaminated by the scalar stuff, which is much, much stronger. So what was measured essentially is the power spectrum for these B modes. So you can define a C sub L for these Bs. And you can go out and try to measure them by doing the same kind of thing you do for the temperature, just summing the squares of these A sub Bs. And the BICEP experiment did this. So it's an experiment at the South Pole. And they measured a particular patch of the sky. And they saw these B modes. They found a non-zero value for this. And everyone got all excited, because this was supposed to be a sign of the gravitational waves during inflation. But it's since been, they underestimated the amount of contaminants in the galaxy due to dust. So it's now, it's, you know, they can't, that claim has been essentially refuted. They haven't actually seen primordial waves with any sort of confidence, because there's these little dust grains that are out in interstellar space. And they are, they're not exactly spherically symmetric. They align within the magnetic field of the galaxy, and they emit thermal radiation that's polarized, because they're not exactly spherical. And that polarization pattern that they produce mimics the same polarization pattern that these B modes produce. So you have to have a good understanding of exactly how much of that dust is out there so that you can subtract the signal and see what's left of the primordial signal. And they severely misestimated the amount of dust that they thought was there. Okay, so that's about all I want to say about the CMB, the actual direct observation of it. We're now going to switch gears and talk about inflation. So go over here. Okay, so let's go back to our picture of the universe in conformal time. So here's the Earth, the world line of the Earth. Here's the Big Bang. Here's the time of recombination when the CMB forms. And here we are observing the CMB. And the period of inflation is supposed to take place down here before the start of radiation domination, which is what we might call the Big Bang. And this is a speculative phase. It's not conclusively, not everyone will agree that this happened. Before we start, I want to go through the three sort of classic cosmological puzzles that the ordinary Big Bang cosmology poses that inflation is supposed to solve for you. So the first is the horizon puzzle, which we mentioned yesterday, which is just the puzzle that if I look at one part of the sky over here, and I look at what its past light cone is, and then I look at another part of the sky, 180 degrees on the other side, and look at what its past light cone is, those two past light cones never intersect before they get to the Big Bang. And in fact, you can calculate, if you like, as an exercise, you can ask, what is the size of this horizon as seen on the sky in the CMB? And you should get that it's roughly 1.5 degrees on the sky, a couple times bigger than the full moon. So any two spots of the CMB that you look at that are separated by more than a few widths of the full moon are causally disconnected if you're only allowed to go back to the Big Bang. So inflation solves this problem essentially by putting more conformal time before the Big Bang so that you can draw these things further back and then they intersect. So this is an easy problem to solve. Any pre-universe scenario that you can think of will generally solve this. You just have to put more stuff before the Big Bang and you'll solve this problem. The next is the flatness problem, which David mentioned. Flatness problem. Okay, so one way of seeing this, let's recall the equation of motion for some fluid with equation of state W. Which implies that rho goes like e to the a to the minus 3 times 1 plus w. So if I look at the Friedman equation, there are the various components of the universe. So let's write in terms of the initial matter density at some time. So rho 0 matter is the initial. Pick any initial time you like and call this the matter density at that time. So this decays, the matter decays like 1 over a cubed. So the equation is this. If I have radiation, let's call it rho r. This goes like 1 over a to the fourth. And there can also be, I'm going to put in something that goes like 1 over a to the sixth, which is essentially anisotropies. And I'll show you in a minute why that goes like 1 over 8 to the 6th. So I'll call that rho A for anisotropies. And then there can be a component from curvature. You saw that if you have spatial curvature, you can think of that as being like a component of the universe, which goes like 1 over A squared. Okay, so the problem is that all these components, as time progresses and the universe expands, these guys all get diluted, but the ones that get diluted fastest are the ones with the highest powers over here. So the curvature here has the lowest power, so it gets diluted the slowest. So as time progresses, this should come to dominate all of these guys. So the question is, why has curvature not come to dominate everything else if it was there to begin with, given that the universe has expanded so much? So that's That's the flatness problem, and we'll see that the way inflation solves that is by putting a new component here that beats the curvature, that has an that falls slower than 1 over a squared. Okay, the third problem is only a problem if you believe in grand unified theories of some sort, and this is the monopole or the relic problem. So if you believe in grand unified theories, you believe that at some very high energy, typically like 10 to the 16 GeV or something like that, that there's a unified gauge theory that describes the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic forces. And these unified gauge theories have simple gauge groups, which when they break down, when you symmetry break to go to the ordinary standard model, they predict the existence of topological relics, field configurations, which are stable by virtue of their topology, and which appear to us low-energy observers as magnetic monopoles. So these magnetic monopoles would form during this phase transition, where you go from this grand unified phase down to an ordinary standard model phase. And the mass of these magnetic monopoles would be roughly of the order of the scale of the symmetry breaking, of this gut scale. And you expect the number of them, you expect that they form sort of topologically, like the field is in one vacuum and then it all sort of settles into another vacuum. And that happens sort of on a, you expect that within one horizon volume of the universe at the time when this transition happens, that one horizon volume can fall into one vacuum, but another horizon volume that's disconnected causally might fall into a different part of the vacuum because it doesn't know about the first one. So the expectation is that for each horizon volume, you will get roughly one magnetic monopole forming. So you can do a rough estimate of how many magnetic monopoles you'd expect to see given the usual Big Bang expansion. So can everyone see this, or should I go over it? Okay. So there's some gut scale, which we'll call M gut. And we'll say that the phase transition happens at a temperature, which is T gut, which is approximately just the same order of magnitude as M gut. And as you pass through this temperature, you sort of break down to the electroweak energy scale. So let's ask, what is the size of the horizon? What is the size of this horizon here at the time T at which you pass through this phase transition? The physical distance of this horizon is what we'll call d produced, which is the distance between each magnetic monopole at the time that they're produced, the physical distance. So this is equal to the scale factor at that time times the expression for the size of the horizon at that time. And we're talking about the very early universes, so everything's radiation dominated. So A, the scale factor during radiation domination, goes like T to the 1/2. So you plug that into here, you find that this goes approximately like T. You now know that during radiation domination, if you're dominated by a thermal bath of radiation, the Friedman equation tells you that the Hubble squared is just T to the 4th, the temperature of the radiation, over M Planck squared. So if you approximate T as approximately 1 over H, and then plug in the Friedman equation here, this gives you M Planck over T gut squared. Okay, so this is the approximate physical distance between these monopoles at the time they're produced. Okay, so, but we want to know how many of them will be around now. So since the time they were produced, the universe has expanded It's expanded by the following factor, just the temperature at that time over the temperature of the CMB now, because the ratio of temperatures is just inverse to the ratio of the scale factors. Okay, so the distance between magnetic monopoles now, the physical distance, is just this ratio times what we calculated over there for the produced distance. And plugging in our expression for the produced distance, dCMB, we get this. So we know the Planck mass. If we plug in what the typical gut scale is here, 10 to the 16 GeV, and we plug in the temperature of the CMB, 2.7 Kelvin, this comes out to roughly 10 to the fourth kilometers. So I used the fact that the gut temperature is roughly the same as the gut scale, which is supposed to be 10 to the 16 GeV. So we expect that today there is a magnetic monopole roughly every 10,000 kilometers or so. So this may not seem like very much, but in fact, it severely overcloses the universe because these magnetic monopoles are so heavy. So if we calculate the density of the magnetic monopoles, rho m, this is approximately the mass of the magnetic monopole per volume, which is roughly the distance cubed between them, which goes like this. And if you calculate out the numbers here and compare it to the critical density today, you find that it's roughly 10 to the 17th times the critical density. So this can't possibly be true because the universe would be all collapsed and gone by now if these monopoles were actually present at this abundance. Okay, so again, this is only a problem if you think that these gut theories are actually there and actually producing monopoles like you think they should. If you don't believe in the guts or any sort of mechanism that can produce these, then this is not a problem for you. Inflation solves this by essentially diluting the universe a bunch after the monopoles are produced. So you imagine that the monopoles are produced, and then inflation kicks in and just vastly expands the universe and dilutes this and brings this 10 to the 17th back under control. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to define inflation I'm going to define it as any period of the universe during which the acceleration a double dot is greater than zero. So this it's not committal as to what caused it. It's just anything you can dream of that causes this behavior in the scale factor, we'll call inflation, because this, we'll see, is all you need to solve these sort of problems. Okay, so you can also write this, a convenient way to write this will be as follows. Either like this or like this. We'll see that this A times H is going to be an important quantity. So these conditions are all equivalent. Okay, so you usually, you, it's customary to talk of the amount of inflation in terms of the number of e-folds. So you use the letter n to denote the number of e-folds, and that's defined as just e to the n is the amount, is the factor by which the universe expands during some period of inflation. Okay, so this is easy to express in terms of the of integrals of the Hubble parameter. So the differential in the number of e-folds is just d of log a, which I can write as dA over a, which I can write as a dot over a times dt, which I can write as h times dt. And then I can integrate this to get an expression for the number of e-folds as the integral between the time at the start of inflation to the time at the end of inflation of the Hubble constant during that time times dt. So this is sort of a typical measure of, that people use to say how much inflation has happened. And we'll see that generally to solve these cosmological problems, the traditional number is you need like 60 e-folds of inflation to solve sort of the worst version of all of these problems. Okay, so the most common example is the case where your scale factor is growing exponentially. So this clearly satisfies this condition, and this is what comes out during in most actual realizations of inflation. Okay, so inflation, it's important to keep in mind, it's not so much a theory as it is a framework. So it's there are many different ways of realizing it, many different theories which give rise to it. So let's ask what kind of matter or fluid do we need in order to drive a phase where the acceleration is greater than zero? What kind of fluid can drive inflation? So let's look at the acceleration equation. Which is just the derivative of the Friedman equation. So this equation is a double dot over a is 1 over 6 m Planck squared times rho plus 3p. And I should have mentioned earlier that I'm using the Planck mass in all these formulas, whereas David used the Newton's constant. So the relation is just that m Planck squared is 1 over 8 pi g. Okay, so looking at this equation, the scale factor is always positive. So to have a double dot positive, we need to have this this part here negative. So so inflation, if it's driven by a single fluid, requires that rho plus 3p is less than zero. So the condition rho plus 3p equals zero is known as the strong energy condition. It's used in certain in proofs of certain singularity theorems and stuff like that. So this, the statement that we have inflation is the statement that we violate the strong energy condition. Okay, so for example, if we have a constant equation of state with a P just given by W times rho, This requirement is the requirement that rho is less than minus a third. Okay, so let's look back at the flatness problem now and see how this kind of fluid with this kind of equation of state alleviates the problem. So going back to our Friedman equation, where we had the initial matter component dropping like 1 over a cubed, the initial radiation component dropping like a to the fourth, anisotropy dropping like a to the sixth, curvature dropping like a squared. We now have this new component, which we'll call rho I for in Flatton or inflation stuff. And now if it has an equation of state W, it goes like a to the 3 of 1 times 1 plus W. Okay, so now we see that if W is less than minus a third, then this component actually grows slower than 1 over a squared. It means this exponent here is actually less than 2. So as time goes by, even though the curvature comes to dominate everything else, this inflationary component comes to dominate even the curvature. And it's so the condition that you have an accelerating universe is exactly the condition that you dominate over the curvature as time goes by, that the component drops slower than 1 over a squared. So you just have to now, you can calculate, if you like, how much inflation you need in order to solve the worst form of the curvature problem you can imagine. So the curvature is unobservable today. All the data is consistent with a completely flat universe. So you can imagine, like, way back at the Planck time, that the curvature was order 1. And then you want it to be diluted to such, you want it to, during inflation, to be diluted to such an extent that even over the remaining entire evolution of the universe, it doesn't regrow to an observable level. If you do that calculation, you find that you need, like, I think it's like 17 eVolts or something quite small, in fact. You don't need very much inflation to solve the curvature problem. Okay. Okay, so next we're going to talk about the most common source for inflation, which is the scalar field. So this is, like, when people talk about inflation, this is usually what's in their mind. We're going to have some scalar field whose evolution is such that it has an equation of state that realizes this condition. And the scalar field's called the inflaton. So let's start with a Lagrangian for a scalar field on an FRW universe. So it has some potential, V of phi. And I'm also going to allow for an arbitrary kinetic function here, G of phi, just because it's easy to include, and I want to use it to illustrate things later. So let's calculate the stress tensor of this scalar field to see what kind of equation of state it can have. So the stress tensor is just given by the derivative of Lagrangian with respect to the metric. and it comes to this. And you can show that the stress tensor is conserved on shell by virtue of the equations of motion. These are the equations of motion. Okay, so now a general scalar field configuration can always be put, the stress tensor can always be put in a perfect fluid form. So the perfect fluid form for a stress tensor is this, rho plus p times u nu u mu plus p times g mu nu. So u here is the velocity vector of the fluid. So it satisfies the condition that it's a unit normalized time-like vector field, which points in the direction that the fluid is flowing. And then rho and p are the pressure. So this is just the generic form for a perfect fluid stress tensor. So the scalar field t mu nu can be put in this form if you define rho like this. Like this. And then u like so. So as long as the scalar field gradient is time-like everywhere, if you just plug these expressions in to t mu nu here, you will recover this form for the stress tensor. Okay, so we can define now an effective equation of state as just p over rho for the scalar field. Okay, so there's essentially two regimes here. We can talk about the case where you have a very wiggly field. So if you have a very wiggly field profile, then these gradient terms are going to dominate over the potential terms. So we're going to have this kind of condition. And this tells you that the equation of state is going to be approximately equal to 1 because the potential terms are unimportant, and then these cancel, and you just get approximately 1. So an equation of state of approximately 1, it corresponds to a scale factor, which drops a density which goes like 1 over a to the 6th. So this is why the inhomogeneities we typically model as a component that goes like 1 over a to the 6, because an inhomogeneous fluid is something which is going to be sort of kinetic dominated here. Okay, the other extreme is a very smooth field. In which case, V is going to be much larger than the gradient terms. So this will give you an equation of state, which is approximately minus 1. This is the kind of thing we need for inflation, because this is certainly less than minus 1/3. In fact, this corresponds to a density that's going to be roughly constant as the universe expands. Okay, just as a side note, you'll see that the equation of state of a scalar field always has to be greater than this minus 1, greater than or equal to minus 1. This is known as the null energy condition. So this, a violation of the null energy condition is considered more serious than a violation of the strong energy condition, because it's usually associated with some sort of instability of the underlying field that's giving rise to it. So that's the case here. If you want to get this to give you a W which is less than minus 1, you're going to have to take a G which has the wrong sign. If you take a G here which is negative, then you can make the equation of state less than minus 1. But a negative G back in the original Lagrangian corresponds to a wrong sign kinetic term, which is called a ghost. A field with a wrong sign kinetic term is going to have a Hamiltonian, which is unbounded from below. It's going to represent an instability in the system. So I should say that it's not a hard and fast rule that a violation of the null energy condition is always associated with some instability. It's the case for normal sort of forms of matter that we know about, or Lagrangians that have no more than one derivative per field. But people have thought up crazy sorts of Lagrangians which yield stable profiles which nevertheless violate the null energy condition. Okay. Okay, so this scalar field is sort of the standard way to realize inflation. We look for a scalar field which is going to be in a situation such that it's potential dominated, so that it has this equation of state of approximately minus 1. Okay, so now let's go back to our canonical scalar. We'll just set G equals to 1. You can always, with a single scalar, there's no loss of generality other than the sign, because you can always redefine the field to eliminate this G. So we have now just a canonical scalar with a potential. So the equations of motion, if I ask for a scalar field which depends only on time to be consistent with the symmetries of the FRW ansatz, the equations of motion become the following. This is the Friedmann equation, which comes from the 0,0 component of the Einstein equation. And then there's the scalar field equation, which involves second derivatives. Which comes from the scalar field equation itself. And these are the only independent equations you need. The ij component of the Einstein equation, you can write it down if you like. It'll give you the acceleration equation, which looks like this. And this is often written in terms of this parameter called epsilon, which is defined as follows. Okay, so these are the two independent equations, and this is a derived equation. You can get this by differentiating this and plugging this in. And this is always the case in any different variant system. There's always going to be an equation which is redundant, which is just related by another identities to the two equations that you started with. Okay, so this is the exact equation. No approximations made or anything. But to get the state of inflation that we're after, it's common to invoke this what's called the slow roll approximation, which is going to ensure that the field is potential dominated and that it has this equation of state very near minus one, and furthermore that this state persists for a long enough time that you get enough inflation to solve the cosmological problems. So I think this might be a good stopping point, and tomorrow we'll continue with the slow roll approximation. So any questions? Yes?
If we had a scalar field at the beginning, what happened to it now?
Yeah, so the idea is that it's still here now. It's still a field, but it's just the mass is going to be so large. So the scale that's typical of inflation is going to be some very high scale. So the mass of the field is going to be near this very high scale. So it would be present now. It's just so massive that you can't produce it. You don't see it. Okay. So see you all tomorrow.